Hello and welcome to the Cannon Fodder Podcast. You made it. You're here. Welcome. Come in. Take off whatever you need to take off. It's real. We are just free as a bird here. We let it hang out. Let it all hang out. I'm Daniel Barnes, and yeah, everything you've heard about me is true. I let it all hang out. I did just say that. So if you weren't paying attention, I let it all hang out. And I also enjoy a touch of Zen, not too much Zen, you know. I think Zen is one of those things where it's like a little goes a long way, you know. But if you're one of those people who doesn't just want a touch of Zen, who wants the whole goddamn thing, well, have I got a guy for you. It's my co-host, Zen Master Corky McDonald.
What's up, everybody? How you doing, Dan?
Man, I'm all right. I am all right. Like I said, I got a touch of Zen.
I came down with a touch myself.
I got a touch of Zen, too.
Ooh, hey.
I've got a towel that says that in the drawer that's somewhere. I got an apron that says touch of Zen.
You're such a wine mom.
Right? Seriously. Well, that's what it says on my necklace, right? So.
Yeah.
Why not? Why not just go for it? Just really, really embrace the personality. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good. I'm excited to talk about Blake Edwards' Zen, this film we're watching tonight. Dudley Moore, man. Ooh. Can he do it or what?
Man.
That guy.
Really. And boy, touch. They don't. The touching is very upsetting.
Name a Blake Edwards movie that didn't deal with a man just being an absolute horn dog. Go.
The Carrie treatment?
Nope.
No?
Damn it. You were going to say Pink Panther? I knew it. But that's actually what he calls his penis. So it's really all about that.
The Pink Panther. Yeah. Quality stuff. Man, I remember those Pink Panther movies. They used to, on one of the syndicated channels back in the TV pre-cable days, they would do a whole week of Pink Panther movies. I remember probably once or twice a year. And I usually just watched all five of them. It was a Monday through Friday treat. That and the John Belushi week that they would run. the man had like five movies.
I know. I was going to say, you're really stretching. Like Neighbors, Continental Divide?
Just barely, 1941, just barely got in there. But that also was a great treat. From the old UHF days. You know what's also a treat? The movie UHF with Weird Al Yankovic.
Go see it. Delicious. I think we saw that in the theater, didn't we?
We did. We saw it together.
Yeah.
I think we saw it. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how could you not? Weird Al Yankovic, my God. Conan the Librarian?
Right? Don't you know the Dewey Decimal System? Buddy, that lives in my head for 40 years. That
rent
has been
free
there.
And loving it. You know,
I couldn't tell you
squatter's
the name
rights.
Of the five people I met today, but I can tell you that.
Oh, no. Yeah. Long after I've forgotten all my loved ones, I will still remember. Conan the Librarian at UHF. So that's something to look forward to, I guess.
You know what else is something to look forward to, Dan?
Hit me.
Getting our PayPal donors all in a row,
yep,
and individually walking by, slapping high fives, yeah, shaking hands, bowing and curtsying, yep, groveling and thanking them.
Yes.
Genuflecting before all of them, mm-hmm, because without them, this show wouldn't exist. They are the donors to the show. They are the heroes of the show. They are the Woosha masters, mm-hmm, of, mm-hmm, our show. And we thank each and every one of you for your support.
And if you would like to join the League of Heroes and donate to the show, we tried to make it pretty easy. Just go to daredaniel.com, find the menu, find support the show in the menu. There's also a donate button there on the homepage. Make a one-time donation, monthly donation, yearly donation. I think you can make a donation in the next life, you know, just depending on, you know, where you were in this realm. Any contribution, honestly, any contribution really helps keep this show going. Thank you so much.
The IMDb synopsis for Touch of Zen? A lady fugitive on the run from corrupt government officials is joined in her endeavors by an unambitious painter and skilled Buddhist monks.
Yes, this week's film, it's A Touch of Zen, written, directed, and co-edited by King Hu, a.k.a. Hu Jinquan. He was born in Beijing, spent most of his life in Taiwan, as well as a little in Hong Kong as well. King Hu, he is not known for his romantic comedies. He is not known for his domestic dramas. He is not known for his taut and timely political thrillers. King Hu is known for Wuxia. Wuxia, W-U-X-I-A. It's, if you don't know, it's a martial arts subgenre dealing more with historical fantasy set in ancient China. The fighting is generally more graceful. There's less pure violence. It's less gravity bound. The tone is a little more romantic and spiritual. And A Touch of Zen is Hu's most famous and most celebrated wuxia and film just overall. A Touch of Zen, it was based on a classic Chinese story called Xinu in the book Strange Stories from a Chinese Studio by Pu Songling. It's set in the Ming Dynasty. Originally, it was released in two parts. The story is kind of similar to Kill Bill, actually. It's just like, it was originally set to be one movie, but the budget grew, the ambition grew, it just kept getting bigger and more. And at a certain point, it was he was compelled to release what he had as part one. Filming started in 1968. The first part was released in Taiwan July 10, 1970, while filming was still going on. The second part was released in Taiwan November 18, 1971. I believe they cut it right at the fight in the bamboo forest.
Okay.
Or right after that, and then kind of re-brought it back for the beginning of the second film.
Gotcha.
As well. It was a huge failure in Taiwan. Huge failure. Big bomb. The films were combined into one movie in November 1971 for the Hong Kong market. Huge failure there, too. Just did not connect with audiences for whatever reason. However, the full put-together three-hour version, one film screened at the 1975 Cannes Film Festival. It was nominated for the Palme d'Or, and that's where it kind of started as an international sensation. It was fully restored and rescreened at Cannes 40 years later in 2015. And as we saw, it says it at the beginning of the Criterion print of this film, funding comes entirely for the restoration came from Xu Feng. She's the woman who plays Miss Yang in this film. She's the lead actress in this film.
Yeah.
That's a baller move, right?
Yeah.
Just to like, I'm so good in this movie, I'm just going to fucking restore it myself. Fuck all y'all. That's awesome. Today, it is tied at number 225 in the most recent Sight and Sound Critics poll. Just barely made it in there, one or two votes into making that top 250. It's tied with 18 other films, including many Cannon Fodder inductees, Taste of Cherry, Cries and Whispers, and Happy Together. It's also tied with Flowers of Shanghai by Taiwanese great Hu Xiaoshen. He also made a film called Goodbye Dragon Inn. This is just a weird coincidence. That film's about the last night at a movie theater. And what film are they screening? They're screening Dragon Inn by King Hu. So the influence of this film, Hu's work in general on any martial arts filmmaker, but I think Taiwan and Hong Kong filmmakers especially, just immeasurable. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, that's the most obvious, like, It's inspired a lot by what Hu's doing here in this film, the style of it, and really kind of builds upon that because it takes it to another level. But also just about any major Taiwan or Hong Kong filmmaker, Wong Kar-wai, John Woo, Ang Lee, Tsai Ming-liang, so many more from those great world cinemas. Corky.
Mm-hmm.
A Touch of Zen. Did it touch that part of you that inducts films into the canon? Or did it touch a different part of you that you're like, hey, watch it, buddy?
While we're all about consent here at the Cannon Fodder podcast, it is a wuxia movie. So, you know, inappropriate touching is expected because
all over the
you're going to have to fight off a really mysterious no good person who's not, doesn't say a lot. You're going to have to fight off an obviously evil person who, you know, may or may not have his balls. So there's a lot of inappropriate touching happening. I thought this movie was great, but I don't consider it one of the greatest films of all time, and I probably will not be canonizing this movie.
Yeah,
it's overlong. Mm-hmm. There's nothing this movie doesn't like to do in 10 minutes that it couldn't do in 5 minutes. It's very helpful in this movie where that's all about mood.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything is mood, leading up to a fight, before a fight. And let's even say like the first 30, 40 minutes where there's no fighting at all. It's all mood and exploration of this setting. You start from the jump with setting up the mood of it because we're 6 minutes in of establishing shots. That's all we have for the first 6 minutes. It's just establishing.
Yeah.
I'm talking.
Shots of nature.
Shots of nature.
Mountains and trees. And then this town sort of waking up. Right.
That's it. That's what you get. And that's kind of repeated throughout with not just establishing shots, but conversations, reactions, all that kind of stuff. And then the fighting goes fast. Like,
yeah,
I could only imagine how fast that must have looked to an audience then.
Oh, wow. It looks pretty fast now, right? Yeah. I mean, it's really, really stunning to see something like that. Yeah.
But yeah, beautiful, beautiful movie.
Ooh, yeah, epic. I mean, it's like an epic film that only has like, you know, maybe like 10 or 12 real like speaking characters, you know, like it doesn't have that many important characters. It has like big armies and things like that. But yeah, it really is a gorgeous film. To me, Corky, you and I, we're both sports fans. Right.
Yep.
Football fans, both, but I think sports fans in general. But you know, if you followed a game like on a website and you look at the box score now, they do this like win percentage thing, and it's like the win percentage gets updated with every single play. Right. It's
sure.
Like, the Seahawks run the ball for 3 yards. Our win percentage went from 59.7 to 59.3, like based on that one play. And then if you get a touchdown, your win percentage jumps way up, right? It's just charting like as the game goes on, how likely are you to win, right? And you see some of these crazy win percentages, they jump up and down. If you could track my likeliness of like sound percentage, like how likely was I to give this a sound, this movie would have started kind of low and been a needle just pointing up and up and up and up and up all the way through. It just like, it does start slow. It does start very slow. As you said, a lot of establishing shots, a lot of just, I don't think the first line of dialogue comes until maybe we're 10 minutes into the movie.
Yeah, it's pretty long.
The first action scene, there's almost no action in the first hour of a 3 hour martial arts movie. I mean, that's a bold, confident choice by the director, or a crazy choice by that. But the movie just keeps getting better and better and better. And once the action does start, on and on and on until that just like astounding, like transcendently psychedelic ending, which just like blew me away. It just like the needle just kept pointing up and up as it went on and on. So this is an absolute sound selection for me. We'll see if I can convince you as we go on. I didn't always understand this film on a cultural level. I think there's things I did not get. Certainly on a spiritual level, what it's saying about Buddhism and all those things. But I think there's some universal languages here. Style. Man, does this movie have style to spare?
Absolutely.
What an absolutely stunning film. Atmosphere, and as you said, it tone, like it's just like you don't necessarily understand it, but you feel it. You feel this movie very much so, in a way that I think you like feel meditation without being able to exactly grasp it, without being able to quantify it or explain it in some sort of way, but you get something out of it. You feel it in your body. So I think it does have this really slowly unfolding narrative with all these people who have all of these secrets and things. But I just felt like once it got going, it just like absolutely blew me away. And a lot of the fighting, like as you said, Everything is extended. Everything, it mm-hmm. really gets extended out. To me, I was thinking, and I don't know if this is like time-wise, if this is an influence or a coincidence, but I was thinking of Leone, especially Once Upon a Time in the West and the
end. Dude!
The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, because there are so many, like, I'm staring at you. And it's also like the way the action comes suddenly, and then there's no action. Then it's 5 minutes of like staring and posturing and walking around and kind of like looking and sizing each other up. And then the action just is fast and furious, right? Like it just has yeah. these like shifts in pace, shifts in tone, shifts in style that are just so like energizing. Like it's just a really outstanding.
There's a sequence where it follows the lead around. And he's not actually the lead as it turns out, but he's the one we follow first.
Yeah. I started writing my notes and I said, this guy Goo, he's our protagonist. Mm-hmm. And I was like, not really though. Because where that film ends up in the third act, he really gets kind of pushed to the side. Like I think like, as I was saying, this is a groundbreaking movie in terms of editing, cinematography, style, martial arts, all those things. It's also pushing the outside of the envelope in story and character yeah. development and how you can relate to characters like within this sort of epic story. But sorry, I interrupted you. But yeah, Goo. No, Goo is this guy's name.
There's a sequence we follow Goo around in this darkened home that's haunted, and there's this noise that's coming, and I wondered if it was from something diegetically or if it's the soundtrack, and it turns out it's the soundtrack, and I'm like, oh, this is Leone. This is Once Upon a Time in the West. And this also inspires Kill Bill. This is like the fight scene at the House of Blue Leaves with that noisemaker in the garden, just kind of ratcheting the tension every little bit. So it does. It harkens to all of that, you know?
Yeah. 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 I mean, Kill Bill's like a grab bag of influences, you know?
Sure. And that's a little Tarantino. Bit of it.
A little bit of it is Wuxia, you know, absolutely. Yeah. And as I said,
Shaw Brothers.
This movie was also like cut into two pieces, just like Kill Bill was, and eventually reunited as Kill Bill was as well. But yeah, well, we should definitely talk about the action as well.
Sure.
Because like, it's a kind of slow, contemplative, meditative film where you're not really sure what's going on. And everyone's kind of like, everyone's sort of looking and, what's that guy doing? And I don't really know. I'm going to follow him, but I still don't really know what's going on. And where is she? And everyone's just like kind of mysterious. There's just lots of intrigue for almost the first like 45 minutes of this movie. And then the action starts and it's just like, it just keeps building and building and building and building, sort of like Matrix Reloaded style, where it gets bigger and bigger. The fights just get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. But it's a lot of it's done with editing, right? Like it's
absolutely,
not really
yes.
like it's not done with wires or special effects or anything like that. And it's not necessarily like, wow, that's an amazing individual performer. You know, there's a Bruce Lee like doing things that are just absolutely outstanding. It's all about like the choreography. It's all about the editing. It's all about the cinematography,
and sound effects,
the composition, and the sound effects. These like these sounds of like their robes just like flipping around because they're not really bound by gravity. They are, but everyone is just sort of like they're bouncing. Like it's very acrobatic. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. they're bouncing. They're leaping. They're jumping down. And it doesn't always make sense in like a traditional spatial logistical way, right? Because
sure.
like not just that people are leaping 20 feet in the air or things like that, but it's like someone will be on front of you and then they're behind you, or they're on top of you and then they're on your side somehow, you know, but it does make sense. It's like they're creating their own sort of like logistical reality within this kind of new rules that King Hu is making for these fight scenes. But man, they are really, really stunning. And I think there's this like back-to-back sequence, maybe I guess back-to-back-to-back sequence that is in the center of the film, right? So we have this start here where There's Goo. He's our protagonist. He's like a slacker, sort of. I mean, he's a scholar, yeah. but he doesn't have any real, like, purpose, and he doesn't want to have a purpose.
No, he's a scholar in a very remote area where you get the feeling like he's just comfortable being the smartest guy in that area.
Exactly. Exactly. And his mom's always giving him shit, too. Yeah, yeah. Mom's always on his case. There's a woman, a poor woman, who's this village is supposed to be haunted. Everyone's always talking about ghosts.
I mean, they live in abandoned homes yeah. just because that's what they can afford. They don't pay rent there.
Yeah,
right?
There's this fort, and they live there. It's abandoned, and everyone thinks it's haunted, but it's free, you know, so the price yeah. is right. And there's a poor woman there, and she's very mysterious. And then there's a stranger who comes into town, you know, the man with no name, except he does have a name. It's Us Yang. But he's who's this guy? Some kind of bounty yeah. hunter or something like that. And then who's this other guy who's also being very mysterious? One of the merchants in the town is kind of mysterious.
Why is the new guy asking about the other
guy? Why are they here? Where'd she go? She was just here. And then we see she's hiding on the ceiling somehow. You know? So like everything's just like, what is going on? And he's trying to figure it out. And we're with him. We start with him because he's as in the dark as we are, right? So
yeah.
it's like we're finding out all these things as he's finding it out. And this woman, she seems just like a very demure, poor woman who's just, you know, taking care of her old granny or whatever, until out of nowhere, just attacked by two people. And she
right.
says, stay out of this. You know, she goes full like Trinity in the Matrix, and it's just like, no, I'm way more badass than you are, right? I mean, like, it's just like the action comes out of nowhere sometimes, right? And it's just this amazing fight. She's flipping around, she's got the sword and everything like that, she's leaping all over the place. And then there's just so many beautiful shots and sequences in this film, but like the changing of the POV in this middle of this sequence where it's about them fighting and then we go to him watching them fighting from a distance, you know? So it's just
yeah.
all of the ways this film like maximizes the beauty and the grace and the impact of the action is just really, really impressive. But as it turns out, she's a quote unquote criminal. Sentenced to death by a corrupt and sadistic eunuch because of her father's quote-unquote insult, which was really just exposing the eunuch as corrupt.
Right.
And that's it. And that's why she's, you know, on the run. She has these two protectors who have taken a protector that's Shi, I think, and Dr.
Yeah,
Liu.
Yeah, General Shi.
General Shi and quote-unquote Dr. Liu. This is the merchant who kind of set up in the town. And then she's on the run from Eunuch Y and the Eastern Depot. We got a lot about the Eastern. I didn't expect to hear so much about depots in this movie. But yeah, the Eastern Depot, which is just like some like Pinkerton detectives or some
yeah,
kind of,
yeah.
you know, some kind of gang to you know, get people. And so Goo, you know, offers his help to her. And then in this middle part of the story is all like a big flashback where we go back and we hear her side of the story, right? Which was, you know, we get all this, her father was tortured to death. And that's when it comes to like these really amazing back-to-back sequences. So the first one where they're hiding amongst the rocks,
yeah.
And the armies are coming by, and every time they go into an opening in the rocks, there's somebody else there. They need to hide, and they keep having to hide. And this is another one. Like I said, the Leone reference. Like I watch a lot of Westerns, a lot of classic Westerns. Okay. So many classic Westerns have a sequence like this where someone is hiding in rocks or is on top of the rocks looking down. That's where the ambush happens, or that's where they're hiding, or that's where some kind of like sort of chase happens, or some sort of. Like, exactly like this. I mean, I don't know that that was the intent, because this movie is so, like, culturally, it is very Chinese. It is very mm-hmm. Taiwanese. It is very, like, of its place. But stylistically, there are these kind of, like, Western-y kind of things going on at the same time. So I don't know, you know, as with, like, Kurosawa and Leone, I mean, the influences go back and forth. right? Mm-hmm. Like, yes, Leone basically just stole Yojimbo to make Fistful of Dollars, but then his influence goes back over there because he put his spin on it, and then it comes back and back and back. And I mean, I think that's good, you know? That's great.
Absolutely.
That's art doing its work, artists being influenced by other great artists. But then that sequence leads to like the introduction of the monks, and the lead monk Huiyan, who is one of these dudes. Like this guy, this is the guy who, if you've ever seen the movie poster or any images from the, like if you look at Criterion, if you look at Letterboxd, this is the guy who is like the lead image of the mm-hmm. film. We are like halfway through a 3-hour movie before like the most recognizable person shows up. Like, again, just bold stuff. And this guy becomes like kind of one of the key characters, if not the main and most important character in this film moving forward, strangely enough. And it's He Yuan. And he's one of these like martial arts guys who is like can go off on you, and yet he hasn't moved. You know what
yeah,
I mean? Like
exactly.
Forget breaking a sweat. It's like he hasn't, like a hairs haven't like twitched at all.
Yeah.
Like nothing.
He's going
right?
to beg you to like, repeatedly to not fight him.
Don't do this.
Like, you're going to do it. Yeah, and then right. you're going to get your skull cracked by his finger.
Yeah. So that's another great scene. And then that, so they go with, they follow Huiyan. Yang does, again, we're still in a flashback here, Yang and Lu and Shi, and so they go to this monastery, when that's where we find out, that's where she learned all of these martial mm-hmm. arts. Like, they spent 2 years basically training at a monastery. They leave the temple, and that's when we get this iconic fight in the bamboo forest. And like, this is mm-hmm. where you see, I think, most keenly like the influences on Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. They're just
on everything,
leaping up through these bamboo trees. They're bouncing yeah. off of the trees. They're flipping around over each other and throwing each other around and bouncing in these just inhuman sorts of ways. And yet, a lot of times, you see wire work or you see work like this, and there's something like really artificial about it. I don't know how to describe it, but like, this really feels like this is just how these people move. It's just an extension like of their bodies. It doesn't feel like, oh, I see a wire or that's a trampoline or whatever like that. Like, I know it's a trampoline or it's a whatever it is that they're jumping off of, but the way it's shot, the way it's edited, the way the movements are, it feels like this is just how they move. This is just how these people move.
Yeah.
And you accept it in a very like matter of fact sort of way, even as it's like absolutely fantastical.
And for as much as I've said that the movie is overlong and it takes a long time to do anything, it's not boring in any aspect. It just takes a long time to do the things it does.
Yeah.
And I think you're trained at this point to accept movement as part of just mm-hmm. the storytelling of this movie, because even in the parts where it's just people watching furtive glances and moving around a market, the camera is nonstop sweeping either from left to right or right to left, rack focus, zoom.
Mm-hmm.
It's doing all, there's movement all the time.
Constantly.
So even when it's just characters discussing things in a room or moving around a small neighborhood market, the camera is following and sweeping along all the time. So now when it comes to the point where it's actual mm-hmm. nonstop movement, the camera has trained you to be like, okay, this is the how they get down.
This is just how this universe is. Absolutely. We should also mention, man, I mean, this is like we said, this movie was restored just about 10 years ago, fully restored.
It's oh, yeah.
The colors in this movie. Like, this
yeah.
movie just like pops out at you, right? Like, when somebody is in a close-up or even in a medium shot and you just see their face, it's like, it just has this vivid quality where it's just like it feels like legendary. There's something about it that just feels more real than real in a way. So there's this whole sequence where, okay, so they're completely outnumbered because these armies are coming to get them. Like, they've been found out. They're in this tiny little village. But Gu, this is our slacker scholar, he decides subterfuge. That's the way to do it. He's a Confucian, right? I mean, this is a kind of a thing in the movie that, again, I'm not going to even pretend that I know what the hell I'm talking about. But there is something mm-hmm. here about Confucianism v. Buddhism and other, I think, dichotomies of that sort. And it eventually comes down in, I think, the finale to those two viewpoints facing off against each other, the two best advocates for those viewpoints maybe facing off against each other in the end. But Gu, he has these, he studied military history, he has all sorts of like logic on his side, and there's a really amazing shot where it becomes like this six or eight frames within the frames, and everyone's like spreading rumors. Like he has people spread rumors that there's ghosts in the temple, and so that because he wants to spread set a trap for the army that's coming in, right? And humans can't fight ghosts, you know. This is ancient China. Like people are taking ghosts like pretty darn seriously, mm-hmm. And he basically sets this trap for him where he fools them into thinking there's ghosts everywhere, and it's really just the four or the five of them, and it actually becomes this bloodbath. Now it's in the dark, so we're just sort of seeing it a little bit, and we figure that Gu, who is sort of on the sidelines, kind of orchestrating, maybe doesn't see it. That's followed by the sequence where like the fog, there's an omnipresent fog, I guess we should say. This is yes. Part of the mysticism of the film here, is that there is a billowing fog, like 98% of the scenes. And finally, it's like the sun comes out, the fog actually breaks a little bit as he's walking around like laughing maniacally at how clever he is and how all of his plans work so well. And then he realizes like, I made all these fake ghosts, but I've just created a bunch of real ghosts and I'm surrounded by them, and all comes down. And he realizes Yang is gone. He has no idea where she's gone. So she's left. Oh, and we forgot to say they fucked as well.
Yeah.
Which is kind of where his confidence sort of changed, right? that's an important part of the story to where we're going next. Which is that she has his baby. It's not an immaculate conception. They did it. But she like leaves it for him at sort of the foot of the mountain where the monastery is. She just joined the monks in the monastery.
Yeah, like, and she's like, damn, here's your baby. Go away.
Yeah, like your family name lives on. Bye-bye. But she's immediately called back to these earthly affairs because she has to protect Gu and the baby from the last of the big bads. We finally reached him, right? The big boss.
Yeah, level. I did appreciate that the bads kept getting badder. Like it was really total video game shit.
Yeah, and this is Xu, X-U, Xu. He's the only one who we've seen who can fight on the level of Xi and Yang and the monks. Dr. Lu died during the ghost battle. But he can do better. And what's funny is that he's not the most powerful. He's actually less powerful than several people who we have seen killed already. Mm-hmm. The eunuch died, okay. Usiang died, right? Like that was sort of the man with no name kind of guy. Like all those people, this guy is not above those dudes. Not necessarily like he's the head of this kind of secret army, but he still answers to the emperor, okay? He's still got a boss and he's still got a job to do. I just love that this movie, again, like, talk about a bold narrative decision, okay? Imagine if, like, Neo was not involved in the last fight of The Matrix. You know what I mean? Like, that's where we're at here. Like, this final scene, it's not about, like, it's not about Gu, it's not about Yang, it's not about Xi, it's not about the baby or the mom or any of those people, right? It is the head monk Huiyan and this guy Xu. We've come all this way, and these are the guys fighting in the final scene. It's people fighting for them. But I think also, like I said, fighting for these two ideals, this dichotomy, right? You have Xu, who says, I'm not going to shirk my earthly duty. It doesn't matter that these people were convicted on a lie. It doesn't matter that my boss is corrupt. It doesn't matter any of these things. I have a duty here on earth, and I'm going to do it. Huiyan also won't shirk his duty. He also won't step aside, right? But his duty is a more kind of heavenly duty. His duty is to, like, the tenets of Buddhism. So we have this fight. Xu wins, but then, oh, man, quirky, this last scene. This is where, like, the movie just exploded for me, right? Like, this scene, it's like, it's at the crossroads almost, right? And it's like, it has that level of, like, world sort of shaking impact, right? This, like, fake repentance, this attack, everything seems to have gone completely wrong. And then this like crazy psychedelic ending where like all the perceptions get completely flipped on their head. Huiyan dies, is maybe reborn, is I mean, it's again, I don't understand it, but man, it really made me feel something. It really did. This is an absolutely astounding ending. And I thought a great film. So that's the movie. It's called A Touch of Zen. I hope I didn't spoil too much of it for you. I think there's lots of meat left on the bone. If you ever want to see it, man, I think it's a heck of a 3 hours at the cinema. Quirky, before we wrap it up and give our ratings, is there anything you wanted to mention before we give it?
Well, we talked a little bit before we started recording that you watched it in one go and didn't want to break it up. I had to break it up. I wasn't able to watch it in one go. And I will say it probably suffered for that. Mm. I probably, especially the way you sold it as like the win probability and it keeps creeping up and creeping up and creeping up. Movies can do that. They can have that like rollicking, get you there kind of thing that you get in the rhythm of it. And a good movie, a great movie will move you along and, you know, have a movement of its own and get you enjoying it more and more. I think mine got stilted after having to stop and then restart it.
Yeah, I think that's fair. When I was thinking about like, okay, so they cut this movie, you know, basically right in the middle after the forest sequence. And then I was thinking like, that leaves you with kind of two unsatisfying films. Mm. Because you have one film that's really very slow to get started. And just as it's getting started, it ends. And then you have another one that just never stops, right?
Like
It's just, it doesn't, this film is so much about atmosphere, as we said, and about tone and about feeling and about, especially I think our perception of it, because again, I didn't necessarily grok all of the meaning necessarily of it, but certainly the feeling of it was very, very powerful stuff. So all right, so let's wrap it up and give our ratings. Just to remind everyone, of course, we rate on the slight or sound scale. If we both think that this was a sound selection for the canon, then kaboom, right into the cannon fodder canon it goes. If one or both of us thought it was a little slight, no canon for you, and we'll pick a slighted film not in the sight and sound top 250 to put in its place. Quirky, touches in. Slight or sound?
I'm going to say it's a touch slight.
Slight.
It didn't get there for me.
Yeah.
One thing we did not talk about that I say it was probably my favorite aspect of the movie, even more than all the martial arts, even more than the tone, the composition of the shots.
Yeah.
This is going to sound maybe blasphemous, but it reminded me of a Bob Ross painting where he starts from the back and then by the end of it, he's filling up the foreground. Every shot in this, there's some branches in the lower left corner of the screen. A character's moving from left to right. And then the back right behind them is filled up with this ancient, you know, Chinese architecture. So every shot is like that in the small villages. Because there's like, what, five places that they, the film is set at? In homes and in markets. And then when you're out in the mountains or especially the desert, you're filled up where it'll take up the whole thing, the whole screen, and just show you this how small the character is, or it'll be vast and open. Like there's that scene where they're in the wheat fields and it's just a writer handing a message over to someone who's now got to run it to the emperor. And it just shows the vastness of his empire. And he's just being carried in this palanquin across these empty wheat fields. So all the composition is glorious in this movie.
It really is. Yeah. All technical elements, I think you would agree, highest level possible. I think for you, maybe it was the story, the narrative.
I don't think I've said a negative thing about it. Like,
no,
I've extolled everything. And that's not, that's not common for me. Like I will have a negative thing to say even about movies I really love. Maybe this was sound. Maybe I'm doing the old comeback around on my, because I have nothing bad to say about it and everything I've said is good about it. God damn it. Oh, I'm in a real Confucius v. Buddha situation
here.
Whoa,
man.
All right, I'm going sound. I'm changing Whoa. It up. I'm doing the old Dipsy Doodle.
Classic Corky flip flop.
A wild card.
Put on your flip flops, Corky. I know it's still technically winter, but I think it's flip flop weather because Corky is officially flip flop on A Touch of Zen. So that's two and into the canon. Kaboom!
Kaboom!
Better late than never. Just out of curiosity, did you have a film that you were going to put in its place?
I would say Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. If that's not already on there,
I'm not sure. I don't think it is. And I will tell you this. So let's just pin in this. I was anticipating that you were going to put that up as the slighted film.
But if it was already in, I was going to say Kung Fu Hustle, which I think is the perfect piss take on Wuxia, but still is a good fucking Wuxia movie.
Nice. But I was going to say about Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon that I'm just realizing I don't think I've actually seen it since it came out like 25 years ago.
Oh, really?
And so I would have said maybe and come back to it. So right, I'm actually going to say, let's just say maybe and I'll come back to it because okay. A sound, Touch of Zen's in there. So we've got the base established and now let's see if we can build upon it and put a second Wuxia film in there. So pin in that and sometime in the next few months and certainly before the end of the year, I'll rewatch Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. We'll see if it's canon worthy as well. But A Touch of Zen becomes, I believe, our 68th film.
Hell yeah.
In the Cannon Fodder canon. Good job, everybody.
That's what we thought about Touch of Zen. What did you think about Touch of Zen? Did it touch your Zen? Ew. Did you watch it with us? Had you seen it before? We'd love to hear your take on the film. Please let us know on any of the podcast apps you listen to us on. Leave us a comment on your favorite. Or contact us on Facebook and Instagram at Dear Daniel Pod and tell us your thoughts.
All right, it's that time of the show where we hit up the random number generator and pick the film we'll review in 2 weeks on our next episode. You ready for this, Corky?
Let's go, baby.
Magic time. What do you got for us? We've got, oh boy, Corky, we're headed back to Tarkovsky Town.
Let's go.
Mirror. Maybe one of our most controversial didn't make the canon films. It was
7 years bad luck from this guy.
It was a feather, just a feather off. It was just barely not there. But we get a second chance with Tarkovsky with Andrei Rublev. IMDb synopsis for Andrei Rublev, the lifetimes and afflictions of the 15th century Russian iconographer, St. Andrei Rublev. It's a biopic, I guess, if you want to call it that. Like I said, it was made in 1966. Corky, the film is 183 minutes. So,
oh, Jesus Christ.
Clear some more space in your calendar or a weekend or, take a few sick days or something like that. So we got another big one, long sit. But, I mean, honestly, we've kind of rolled through a lot of the, 85-minute movies here. So this one is available.
You know there's a tennis player called Andrei Rublev?
Is there really?
Andrei Andreevich Rublev is a Russian professional tennis player. Like, he's current.
Well, I don't think it's the same guy, but,
might be an Orlando situation. You don't know.
This film is available to watch on the Criterion Channel. Again, all 183 minutes. If you don't have Criterion Channel, but you still are like, I want to watch a three-hour movie about a Russian iconographer, well, go ahead and rent it. You can rent it on any of your favorite streaming apps. Buy it on your streaming apps as well. I mean, I'm sure there's all sorts of options there. There's probably a DVD or a Blu-ray out there on eBay somewhere. Lots of options. Corky, I'm assuming you've never seen Andrei Rublev.
No, never seen it.
I've never seen it either. I'm excited to see it. I mean, this is one of those movies that is invariably on every significant top 100, top 200, top 50, top whatever list of all time. I mean, this is, and all that has kept me from watching it up to this point is the same thing that has kept me from watching A Touch of Zen to this point, which is that it's 3 hours long.
Yeah,
so,
gotcha.
Now that I'm forced to watch it, I'm very excited about this. Very, very excited to watch Anatoly Solonitsyn as Andrei Rublev.
Until then, follow Dare Daniel Pod on Facebook and Instagram. like and rate us on your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to donate to the show, again, visit DareDaniel.com. We got everything for you there. Mm-hmm. Find support the show in the menu. Look for the donate button. If you're a fan of new movies, check it out. Listen to Daniel review the top films of the day on Single Take with Daniel Barnes. For Cannon Fodder, I'm Quirky Flip Flopper McDonald.
And I'm Daniel Barnes. Until next time, save us a seat in the back row. Bye-bye.